Welcome to the first podcast of the UNIC Network. We are a group of students pushing for climate action in our universities and communities. I'm Sophie.
And I'm Abigail.
And today we will speak about the divestment movement. But what is divestment? Well, put simply, it is the opposite of an investment. You sell stocks, bonds, or your parts in an investment fund. And what does this have to do with climate change? Probably more than you think. Cities, religious organizations, retirement funds, and yes, also universities are investing their money in different ways, including the fossil fuel industry. Universities lend billions of dollars to these companies mining coal, oil, and gas, thereby playing a key role in causing and accelerating the climate crisis. And it is even questionable whether investing in outdated technologies is financially wise, given that in the long run, we will need to refrain from using fossil fuels altogether. The good news is that more than 1,300 institutions have already committed to some sort of divestment globally, including, for example, the cities of San Francisco, Seattle, and Oslo, pension funds, foundations, and also a growing number of universities, including, for example, Stanford, the University of Glasgow, and also Laval University, where our network is based.
Students have been demanding their universities to end investment in assets harmful to the climate. We spoke with a member of Divest Harvard, Suhas Bhatt, who is trying to push for divestment at Harvard University.
That is problematic. So what Divest Harvard is asking for? Well, I mean, I imagine that you have clear demands. Can you tell us about the specific demands that are the front line of Divest Harvard?
Mm-hmm. So Divest Harvard is part of a larger movement of environmental justice and endowment justice. So there's a large endowment justice coalition that wants Harvard to be invested in corporations and organizations that do not engage in exploitative practices. We are specifically focused on fossil fuel because we are interested in how, like, the environmental injustice of being invested in companies that profiteer off the destruction of the earth, and in the long run, perhaps the destruction of humanity itself, fund Harvard's endowment itself, especially because Harvard is very self-sufficient and the marginal benefit of being invested in fossil fuel companies is pretty minimal. So we have three demands. We want Harvard to disclose their investments. We want them to be transparent about what they're invested in with their endowment. Two, we want them to divest from fossil fuel companies. That's our specific demand. Harvard should not be profiting off these companies. And finally, we want them to reinvest that money into companies with ethical practices and community organizations that provide positive impacts on people rather than exploit human beings.
Okay, and what brought you to join this movement? Was that a personal decision that was easy to make, that was natural, or did you friends suggest you to join, or how did it happen?
Mm-hmm. So I wasn't originally convinced by divestment in the beginning when I came to Harvard, but one of my good friends quickly became involved in the divestment movement here, and then he recruited me to join for the action at Harvard-Yale, where we stormed the field. And after that, I mean, that was a pretty moving experience. I was awed at the broad popular support and the impact that the action seemed to have. And then I also thought a lot about the goal of the campaign and decided that I believed in divestment as a practical movement for cultural change. And so that spurred me to join the movement as a full member.
What did they tell you to convince? Was it difficult? Because you were saying at first you were kind of reluctant or suspicious about this. You were not sure it was the right thing to do.
So it wasn't that I didn't believe in divestment. It was more that I was wondering whether divestment was that effective. I'm pretty convinced that climate change is the ultimate existential threat that humanity faces. And I've been convinced of that since I was maybe 15. I read some research papers for a science competition I was taking part in, and I was awed at the state of our global affairs when it comes to climate. But I wasn't convinced that divesting even mattered that much. I didn't think that Harvard had that much money invested in the climate industry. What would one university pulling out its assets actually do? I didn't think it would be that much. After thinking more about it and being with these smart, passionate people who were working very hard in divestment, And thinking about seeing firsthand after being at Harvard, the kind of cultural weight that an institution like Harvard carries, I became more convinced that divestment as a movement could spur on the kind of cultural change that would make fossil fuel investment a more and more untenable thing as time went on, and push for the kind of positive cultural change that's necessary for climate change. So it was never like a principled thing. It was a question of efficacy. And as time went on, and as I spent more time at Harvard, I became more and more convinced of the efficacy of the organization.
While this is a good example of a student activist, it isn't only students who are committed to the fight for divestment. Professors have also been very involved in the movement, and some of them have gone to great lengths to make their voices heard. Professor Greg Michelson has also spoken to us about his engagement in the divestment movement at McGill University and why he has chosen to resign when the university decides yet again not to divest.
In my researches, I found your journey in this movement to divest from fossil fuels began in 2012, thanks to a group of students. So can you explain how this all happened? Who were those students? What really convinced you to join?
I guess all that it took for me was to be asked to help out. I had already read something about the divestment movement and the rationale for it, which seemed rock solid already back then. And when an alumnus who was working with the student group Divest McGill contacted me, probably because I had I'd kind of spearheaded an effort to get a socially responsible pension option at McGill. So I had a little bit of experience in that kind of thing. And it just seemed like a great goal to get McGill to divest from fossil fuel. So it didn't take much to convince me. Divestment by public institutions, if it gets going and develops momentum, is a very successful pressure tactic to get governments to finally do the right thing.
And what made you stay? And did at that time other professors got involved in McGill divest?
It was, a gradual process of building. And that's, Divest McGill has been amazingly successful in many areas. And one of them is not only helping to organize students in support of divestment, but also organizing the faculty. So they contacted individual faculty, but they also prompted us to ultimately in 2014 form a group of our own called McGill Faculty and Librarians for Divestment. And, at that point we had, over 100 signatures on the faculty letter in support of it. I would say that, over subsequent years, the support for it has only grown and grown and grown to the point where our faculty association became solidly in favor of divestment in 2017 and subsequently. So, I would say it's been a kind of a thrilling experience of building momentum.
So my first question is, how did you take this decision to resign? Was there a moment when it clicked? Was there a no going back situation, or really was it a long-term decision?
Well, I certainly thought about it for quite a while, at least a number of months before. There was this plan to come out with the recommendation to the board in early December. And by that point, as I said, the message from pretty much the entire university community was so clear that I just came to the point where I decided that if the board went the wrong way for the third time, because they had considered the issue twice before and rejected it on equally, ridiculous grounds. If it went the wrong way for a third time, I just could not continue to work at the organization with a good conscience. I certainly didn't expect there to be any great impact simply by one person resigning. But as it turned out, although we had had a lot of trouble getting McGill divestment into the media up to that point, students had been quite a bit more successful, but we as professors had often had quite a bit of trouble getting it into the media. All of a sudden, somebody being crazy enough to resign over it made it newsworthy. And so there were quite a few stories in Canadian and more local and even some international media. And I hope that that has helped to generate more pressure and maybe to, you know, help speed up the point at which McGill will actually divest. Because eventually, everybody is going to be divested from fossil fuel. I mean, it's an industry that does not have a long-term future. Systems can and must be changed from within, but usually the most powerful changes happen with a combination of internal and external pressure. And so what I found is that having, you know, helped carry out the internal struggle for many years, my resignation provided an opportunity to start creating a little bit more external pressure as well.
I think it's interesting to note how both Suhas and Greg got involved. Although they have been climate activists for many years, their involvement in their university's divestment movement only began after someone invited them to one of the events, and they ended up being strong advocates themselves for the movement at their universities. And as we have seen, student action on divestment requires substantial organization, perseverance, and the right strategy. Now let's hear what are their advice on getting yourself involved and getting your universities to divest.
I think one thing that you should do when you're getting started, especially if there's no like clear-cut campaign, is just simply talk to as many people as you can. In the dining hall, just people you meet in different clubs or events, just talk to them and do a temperature check on how people feel about fossil fuel divestment or other climate action, and then start putting together essentially a group of people who will just meet and begin speaking about this. Also, talk to professors. Faculty are really useful allies. Ned Hall, one of the Harvard faculty, has done an amazing job organizing a faculty campaign for divestment, and in many ways, he's part of the reason why there was such overwhelming faculty support for divestment. So, speaking to faculty, getting a group of people together, like a certain core of organizers, is, I think, your first real step. After that, start doing research. You have to figure out like how exactly your college's endowment works, how much they have invested, and what you want them to do. Yeah, your essential goal is grow your organization, talk to people, understand the system you're trying to change, and then start staging actions.
What advice would you give to students who'd like their universities to divest from fossil fuels?
Yeah, I guess two things come to mind. One of them is just be creative, and Divest McGill has been extremely creative. The variety of kinds of events and strategies that they've applied is vast. And I guess another thing that I have really come to appreciate is just how kind of one by one these campaigns and movements are. So, you know, you might not get very far by sending out a mass email or, I mean, you will get something out of that, but one of the most satisfying and ultimately maybe most effective ways that these movements gain success is by one-on-one, you know. So for example, when one of my colleagues before the Senate resolution started contacting individual senators that he knew even a little bit, and when people get an individual personal email or message or phone call or whatever, I think it's almost always more meaningful and significant and more likely to get some kind of response than, you know, just a more public and anonymous kind of thing. So get to know your institution, get to know the people there, and keep plugging away and be creative, and also learn from what other campaigns around the world have done, because it is, I think somebody already in 2015 described the fossil fuel divestment movement as the most successful divestment movement in history. And even though some key institutions are still holding out, Harvard, for example, McGill, et cetera, overall, it's been incredibly successful. And the additional divestments keep rolling in. University of Pennsylvania, Oxford University, University of British Columbia. I think one of the most recent ones is George Washington University in Washington, D.C. So, and then finally, just be persistent. I had a student once who did a study of environmental campaigns, and she looked, you know, she looked at a number of different possible explanations for why some succeeded and some failed. And I guess the main overall message or conclusion that she drew is that persistence, simple persistence, is one of the main determinants of whether you're going to succeed or not. I think students approaching professors is one of the most effective ways of making these things happen, because I think sometimes professors are more easily convincible by their students, because, you know, professors, they like to think, yeah, I'm a professor and, you know, I'm helping my students learn. And, you know, there's a kind of, special attitude towards students, whereas, you know, maybe they would be less receptive to one of their colleagues saying, hey, why don't you join this campaign, et cetera. So I think students approaching professors is one of the most effective parts of a campaign like this.
And would you, with your experience, would you encourage them or warn them about against like some specific difficulties you've faced?
Good question. I mean, I think just getting to know the rules of the game of whatever institution that you're at, and where are the opportunities and where are the constraints is key. And you know, that's not something that any of us start out very deeply knowledgeable about. And so, well, yeah, I mean, maybe if I had to do it all over again, I would have, none of us knew how long it was going to take. And if we had kind of been up for that and known about it, we might have started with some of the more effective things earlier, like getting people elected to things like our faculty association, like the Senate, like the Board of Governors, et cetera. If we had started on that earlier, and basically started playing the inside game, because that's coming back to a theme that we had earlier in the podcast, and that is with any difficult change, it maybe is unlikely to happen unless there's both internal and external pressure. And so maybe, you know, just get people elected to whatever positions are available is another little nugget that I might offer.
And what would you say to students who are facing huge administrations? University is a huge institution, and they might fear to get in front of that and claim their IDs. What would you advise? What to begin with?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe the first step is to try to find other students who would also be interested in the project. Second step would be get to know how the university works and how change is supposed to happen. I think it's also an important step, and this is something DeVest McGill has been extremely effective at, and that is to get the lore from previous student generations about what worked and what didn't work in the past.
What would you do? I mean, how do you convince people that what you're trying to do is the right thing?
Mm-hmm. So we've always liked like rigorous argument. So I think that there are a few things that we should like try to show very clearly. So the first thing to show is that climate change is an existential threat. And that's not that hard to show. If you look at like the IPCC's reports, look for other other symposiums on climate, start reading like papers in Nature, look at climate change on Google Scholar, start putting together an unimpeachable argument for why climate change is the existential threat of our era. And then two, the existence of fossil fuel companies in their current form are antithetical to solving climate change. That's the second thing you have to prove. There are a lot of arguments that these companies can keep slowly investing in renewable energy and doing research to counteract their contributions, you have to make it very clear that that is simply not drastic enough compared to the rate of change that we're facing.
Besides divestment, another avenue to make sure that we rely less on companies involved in mining coal, oil and gas is to reduce the consumption of fossil fuels. We would like to present to you an initiative by our UNICE network member Sebastian, who founded an urban agroecology project in Colombia, which focuses on building a self-sustained community with a minimal carbon footprint.
Hello everyone. It is often mistakenly thought that this investment in polluting energy is something very high that only great scientists, companies and governments can deal with, but that is not so true. The disinvestment in polluting energies can save us from a point of no return where our planet would suffer an irreversible agony, and us along with it. So I've developed, with the support of vulnerable communities and volunteer social leaders, the Nebocracy Project, which addresses the issue of disinvestment in polluting energies such as fossil fuels through agroecology. I explain. The urban agroecology that we've been developing allows people to have their own crops in the walls of their homes or gardens. We have developed community gardens that discourage communities to buy imported products, as they can be perfectly grown in their homes or with their neighbors. So that decreases the demand of imported food and thus the transport of food that travel long distance in cars or planes that spend thousands and thousands of liters of fossil fuel, reducing the use of polluting energy and its production decrease. This makes it much easier and faster the transition of our societies to use of clean and socially responsible energy. Not necessarily dams, because in Latin America this has involved flooding large tracts of native forest or lands that were owned by farmers who have been displaced and lost everything they had. We can encourage instead the use of plains that feed off the hidden deserts and areas such as the plains, large extension of land that can be used as solar farms combined with the use of thermal and wind energy. These strategies of disinvestment in fossil fuels must be combined with social policies to really make effective the decrease of the carbon footprint. With small investments by the government, we could obtain great results.
That marks the end of our podcast. We would like to thank the UNICE Network and of course Suhas and Greg for dedicating their time to share their experience.
We hope you have enjoyed this podcast and do stay tuned for our next one. Till next time.